I'm Laura Vinroot-Poole. For over 20 years, I've owned Capital, an internationally recognized specialty store in Charlotte, North Carolina. On this podcast, we unlock the stories of people's lives through the stories of what they wore. These aren't conversations about fashion. These are conversations about people.
Everybody wants to know her.
Stefan Jansson visited Capital to share his collection with our clients and also to share his partner, author, and horticulturalist, Umberto Pasti. There's so much to learn from Stefan. I hope you love his story of designing a gorgeous collection on his own terms and a love story that supports an entire village in Morocco. Stefan Jansson, we're so excited to have you in Charlotte. You were here with your partner, Umberto Pasti, and we had a beautiful event at Winghaven last night for you to talk about his beautiful book, Eden Revisited. And now you're here with me for a trunk show, and I'm thrilled you're here.
But, you know, the way the whole thing started, I mean, I was so happy to come here because I've seen you working, and I was very curious to meet your people working with you, your ladies. But the way things started yesterday, I mean, this kind of Moroccan night that was not even, it looked so natural.
It was beautiful.
And the crowd that was there, I mean, you were at a point you want to meet everyone in Charlotte. It's like, because all the people are nice. There was a fantastic woman who gave us an iris, which is happened to be my favorite iris
really?
In the world. It's called the Fulvo, because it's kind of amber, ginger, red color, but very subdued. And it's just an iris on its own. I could not believe she was giving us this.
So how are you going to get it home?
Can't say it officially.
You can't say it officially. Can you tell the listeners where you're from?
Well, I'm from another wonderland. I was born in the south of France and in a lovely, lovely place called Provence. Nothing in my life and family would have brought me to the industry I'm working in, which is fashion. But I have to say that having a lovely childhood in the middle of nature has really forged me in a way that I didn't expect. I actually realize more now what it brought me than back then when I was dreaming to be in Paris to be a couturier.
What's your first fashion memory?
My first fashion memory, it's very easy because I was 8 years old. And coming back from school, I saw in the entrance of my grandmother's house the cover of this magazine, which featured a dress. I had no idea what it was, but it became like an iconic dress, the Mondrian dress by Yves Saint Laurent. So that's January 65. And I thought it was so amazing. And I told my grandmother, you ladies all have to wear this. And she explained that that would be nice, but neither her or her friends could be couture clients.
You have a very fashionable mother. What's your first fashion memory from her?
Oh, the first fashion memory of my mother is, first of all, it's wigs. Because in the 60s, there was this thing with wigs that they could change them like scarves. So I would see my mother once a month. I grew up with my grandparents. And one day she was that lovely brunette with curls. And the months after, she had this incredible ginger bob. And then the months after, she had like long, curly, blonde hair. And I remember at one point, we were waiting for my mother to arrive. And we were on the porch. And when the door of the car opened, even my grandmother had a hard time. And she gave me a elbow and said, "That's your mother." We all knew it was my mother, but she was, I mean, you couldn't. And plus, in those years,
Danielle,
fashion was like, you know, miniskirts or midiskirts. So everything was very ups and downs. But the first fashion memory I have of her is in a Pucci dress, because she left the beach and put that dress on. And on her way back to Paris, she just stopped like for a while. So she was wearing a beach dress. And I thought it was so cool. It was like little birds flying around. I didn't ask anything. I asked then after my grandmother said, I have no idea what it was, but it was nice indeed. Another moment before I forced my mother to dress in nothing but Saint Laurent, she was a big Cardin customer and she would never come to fetch me at school. The only time she did, I remember it was such an embarrassment because, you know, it's coming out of school and I hear all my chums laughing and laughing. So what's that? And then I arrive and my mother is wearing this huge black fox hat with a red cape by Cardin with holes on the side and the patent leather belt. I mean, she was going to have lunch with a friend who was next door to my school. And I said, Mommy, what are you doing here? So, oh, just passing by, so you're not happy? Said, let's move out of here. Super embarrassed.
Does she still have all of her clothes?
No, because when her figure changed, which is quite recently, only like 15 years ago, she gave everything away. And the moment she gave everything away, then she said, I could have sold all that stuff. I said, well, now you gave it. Fine.
Well, I also love that you told me the story that she took all of the labels out because they bothered her and she thought they were vulgar.
Yeah.
And now she said, you said you probably couldn't have sold a mother because they had no labels in them.
Yeah. And also those labels are still in the same box where they've been all accumulated over the years because she wanted to make pillows. And of course, she never made the pillows, which would have been even worse to have a pillow with all those labels.
When you moved to Paris with your mother, you were 13 and that was around the time that you met Saint Laurent. Can you tell me about that?
Well, that was quite magic because, I mean, the reason why I wanted to be a couturier is because that dress on the cover, the Mondrian dress, made me dream of a world that I didn't even know exist. And my mother had remarried with this guy who was in show business and he was very good friends with Zizi Jeanmaire, who is a very famous ballet dancer, but who also became like a kind of Broadway entertainer in Paris. She had a show at the Casino de Paris. And of course, I loved her because she was dressed on stage and in life by Yves Saint Laurent. So she was among my idols. So I started going there every Sunday afternoon to see the show because I was at school. So it was Sunday afternoon. And after a while, she noticed me in the audience, wanted to know who I was, and we kind of became friends. She had no idea I was 14 because I looked older and I dressed older. And one day she tells me, I didn't get it from you. Do you want to be a singer or a dancer? Because those were our two understandable professions. And I burst out laughing and said, no, I want to be a couturier. And to which she answered, oh, great. Come on Wednesday night. I'll introduce you to Pierre and Yves. And I freaked out. I thought I would never make it, but I did make it. And that's how I met them.
And what were they like?
Well, the encounter was, I mean, I was shaking. Mr. Saint Laurent was so shy and he couldn't care less about this little thing. You know? Thank God Pierre Berger was there and was much more entertaining. Shy, Pierre never was. So he got into me. When they discovered that I lived the street just behind Rue La Faisanderie, which was behind Rue Spontini where they had the couture house.
And your room, your childhood bedroom looked out over to the
My childhood bedroom, which was actually the maid's bedroom, but I had insisted to have that room because it had a back view on the back of the house of Saint Laurent.
Amazing.
And
could you see inside?
No, I could see only the roof of the thing. Mm. Well, years later, Pierre told me, I'm glad you couldn't see because I mean, it's very secret what we do up there. For me, it was enough to see the roof.
Yeah. Pierre invited you to a couture show.
Yeah. The day we met, he said, would you like to see a show? And I said, sure, I would like to see a show. And I received this invitation for Wednesday at 11. I will never forget that. And of course, I had to beg permission to go and skip school. So the Wednesday arrives and I go around the block and there is nothing. I mean, the street is just as empty as every weekday. You know? I say, well, it's not as imagined. So I climb up the few stairs that went to the salon and this terrible woman looks at me from head to toe and I pull out my card. She looks at it, burst out laughing and say, oh, honey, it's next week. And I could not believe I was so stupid. And so I had to come back and I was hoping that I would have permission to come back, but I did. And that's when the magic happened because, of course, I saw all the Rothschilds in the world and the Catherine Deneuve and Zizi Jeanmaire would look at me and say, what are you doing here? I say, well, thanks to you. Okay, thank you. And then the top press, like the Diana Vreeland, and I was in heaven. Then the show started and everything, oh God, if I close my eyes, I can still feel it again. everything vanished, and I could see just the magic of the clothes, the way it was made. Because back then, the shows, you literally had the girls stepping in front of you. They were not yards away on a big stage, and they had don't even have a number. There was this voice going numero un, number one, and that was it. Yeah, and you had to remember which one, and you had the program, which was very nice.
You could circle
on the description with beautiful descriptions. And I thought it was incredible. And after the show, Pierre Berger saw me. He said, "You didn't like it?" I said, "Why do you say that?" I said, "Oh, you have a strange face." I said, "No, but Pierre, it's a very difficult job." And he looked at me and said, "Oh, good, you have got that. Okay, that's good. You're on the right track. Yes, it's a difficult job."
Yes, it is. And what do you remember about the show? Do you remember what collection it was?
Or? Oh, I remember very well. Also, because in the program that I read before the show started, there was ombre chiffon dresses with ostriches from South Africa. I said, what's that? And those dresses came out with colors of black and white, natural. They are not dyed. They are natural. That were like a freckle of snow around the face, and it was so beautiful. It was the collection, the winter collection, 1971.
Wow.
And stunning.
How did you have the wherewithal to go by yourself, even at 15 years old, to the Saint Laurent show?
No, but it's even beyond that. Also because that was the crowd that I had dreamt of getting close to. And as they accepted me, actually, I was extremely lucky because I think I arrived in their life at the moment of the construction of the myth of Yves Saint Laurent, where they had all the elements already. They didn't have to invent them. They had them, but they were just kind of putting them in perspective.
Right.
I was the young fan. And it's something they didn't think of, but that worked because I was well brought up, good manners. I could speak languages, so I could be introduced, be invited to dinners. And so I fit in the construction of the myth. And so, of course, I thought it was natural, even though I knew it was incredible. But then also my friend Amy Sullivan, who has been my friend ever I'm 17, she was of the Andy Warhol crowd. So, of course, when Andy was coming to Paris, I was hanging around with him. For example, to me, it's so funny that Goyard now is a famous brand, because the first time I discovered Goyard, it's with Andy Warhol, because that's where he would buy the leash for his dog. And nowhere else. And he took us to that place, and I said, "Oh, that's." And I went to my mother. I said, "Do you know Goyard?" I said, "Oh, that's the thing that the competitor of Vuitton." I said, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "No, actually." And she got me a Goyard luggage for my 18th birthday. At this point, but you know, it was normal. I knew that Andy Warhol was super, and Fred Hughes and all that. But strangely, I thought it was normal also because it was my kind of, at school, I would never speak about those things.
Sure.
But it was like my other life. And then I would go to school. I was very, very good at school. I was always the first of the class. So my family was like, okay, fine, you can do your other stuff as long as you're the first of the class. It just went on like that. And all those meetings were so natural.
Yeah.
When I moved out of the scene, I realized, I said, "My God, you are nuts." I remember the first time they invited me to come down to Marrakesh, I must have been like 16. And that's when I said, "So I have to ask permission." And Pierre said, "Permission of what?" I said, "Well, to my mother." I said, "But how old are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm 16. He said, "What?" He knew I was young, but he thought I was at least 18. I said, "No, I'm 16. He said, "But you mean when I met you, you were 14? "Yes." "Oh my God."
I also think it has a little to do with grandparents. You were raised by your grandparents. And I think that people that had strong relationships with their grandparents are very sure of themselves, it seems, in my life.
You got it completely. I mean, my grandfather sadly died when I was really young. I was 9. But my grandmother, with whom I stayed till the age of 13, I was her god.
Yeah.
And also because I was born the day of the crazy people in the south of France. So that made
the 28th of March.
Exactly. And that made my childhood wonderful, because whatever I did, it could have been worse. So everything went fine. And I grew up with so much love and so much security. I have no doubts.
Yeah.
And even all our family history, that my grandmother was from a very wealthy family on that, and she had married this guy who had no money, but she was madly in love with it, and then who made his fortune.
Yeah.
And that. So money was taboo.
Yeah.
I mean, I never heard of money till I moved to Paris. I didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
So all these elements made it that my life was just like a magic flying carpet. And say, I want to meet Yves Saint Laurent. Dong, it was Yves Saint Laurent. And oh, it's Andy Warhol. Dong, it's Andy Warhol. And then same thing with, because of my stepfather's job in show business, I knew all the singers. Yeah. And so they were no longer TV people. They were like people who would come to the house and, you know. So it was crazy, but that's how it was.
What's the most important lesson you learned from Mr. Saint Laurent and Mr. Berger?
Well, it's, you're absolutely right. It's two very different things. Huh. From Mr. Saint Laurent, actually, I remember once I was, after the show, there was a party at home, and back then I must have been like 16. And Mr. Saint Laurent was already getting tired of me because I was too in admiration of him, and he didn't like that. And I told him about the collection. He turned to me and he looked at me very icily cold. He said, my only real talent is timing, with that rhythm. And I thought he had dismissed me with this. And I went, and again, Pierre Berger said, what happened? Say, oh, Pierre, he just told me something really terrible. Said, what did he say? Said, this thing about timing? Say, honey, that's to prove he really likes you, because that's what he thinks. He said, I'm so lucky to have this pulse of timing.
Yeah.
Which is something I never had. So that I didn't learn. But what I learned from Saint Laurent is to be accomplice.
Accomplice.
Accomplice for women.
Yes, a friend. I mean,
more than a friend. It's like
a partner in crime.
Siding with you.
Yes.
Partner in crime, yes.
Yeah, he did do that. And you absolutely do that. That's interesting.
I know that's what he got me. Of course, the sense of color that, having worked both at Kenzo and being befriended Saint Laurent, color is a natural thing to me. And actually, when I started my own line, everything was black and solid. So my only reason to exist was to be prints and colors. And of course, the buyers at the beginning said, who wears that? Hopefully someone. So of course, now that fashion is very much like prints and colors, I feel gray, black, navy, and brown. But my team tells me, the first thing they ask is, what are the new colors? So we can't answer blue, black, gray.
You went to school in France and studied fashion.
Yes.
And from there, went to work with Kenzo.
Yes.
Who was a genius.
A total genius. People don't realize it now. But yeah. I mean, the whole industry has to be so thankful to him, because he opened so many doors. And also the joy that came with Kenzo. And yeah. Also something very important. It corresponded to a change of society, but also that clothes that people could afford with that change. Because I remember back then you had the likes of Thierry Mugler starting, Claude Montana starting. Their clothes appealed to a young, hip crowd, but that could not even buy a belt from them. Right. So it ended up on the wrong person on that. Versus Kenzo had that power that he was ageless. You had cool kids from the street wearing Kenzo, the young Baroness of Rothschild, who was a big fan, actresses on that, everyone, men and women. And a lot of clothes were also already gender crossing. I mean, it was not
interesting.
And it corresponded. I remember the first time I was invited at Kenzo dinner party at home. I was looking around, there was no table. So where's going to be the dinner? And the dinner was served and they all sat on the floor. And for a little bourgeois like I was, I said, okay, I'll eat on the floor. But it was
welcome
like,
to fashion.
Wow. And it was just because he's Japanese, so it was normal to sit on those big cushions and have dinner there. Going on in my life, living a lot in Morocco, I'm used to sit on the floor now.
And what do you think you learned from Kenzo?
Well, Kenzo, actually, the first time I went there, I was helping during the night. I was still going at school and I was 16. And I would come home, do my homework, rush to Rue Saint-Anne where the atelier were, work all night, then go back home, pretend I had been sleeping, go to school for months. And I remember the first fitting when the clothes arrived and Kenzo wanted to see them. And instead of putting them on the model, he was putting the clothes on himself. So to me, to see a man putting on women's clothes was like so bizarre.
He wanted
the feeling of the dress. He didn't want to look at himself dressed in a dress.
Yeah.
He just wanted to get the feeling. And as soon as he got that, he was looking in the mirror, then took it off and then next. And to me, that was an incredible thing.
Yeah.
And I had no judgment, but I understood what he wanted.
Huh.
And actually, the season after, I remember we were all assistants And it was a winter collection where there were so much knits, like sweaters and scarves and hosiery and socks and gloves and hats. And Kenzo would put a dress and we had to bring the accessories. And the other assistants would bring the trays with all the colors of the hosiery. And I was like a free help. I was not even on the payroll or anything. Mm-hmm. But when my turn came and I saw the dress he had picked, I made a selection of three hosiery, three gloves, you know, and presenting the thing. And they all told me, that's not the way to do it. But I was there already. And then Kenzo, who didn't look at this point, look at the tray, looked up and said, merci. And I mean, I was there to help, not to make his life more complicated.
Yeah.
And so I guess what I learned from Kenzo, it's an immediacy of answers to mixing colors, things like, because I thought the other assistants were making a mess.
Right.
But, you know, I was a kid, but I just didn't want to be part of the mess. So I made a selection. Luckily, he thanked me for that. And it went on, our relationship went on like that, which was wonderful. And he told me about, you know, just use your eyes. Don't get confused by influence of other things. And it's your eyes that count. And then if they like it, good. If they don't, well, too bad for them.
And then from there, Dion von Furstenberg.
Dion von Furstenberg was quite an unplanned move.
An exciting move.
Yes. Because we met, I was staying at friends in Venice, and it's the first time I was in Venice. I was 18. And she came for lunch. So we, the kids, were kicked out of the house. Said, go and visit the museums. We're having the Princess Furstenberg for lunch. Okay, great. We came back like around 5:30, 6 in the afternoon. She was still there. And we had tea together and we started having so much fun together. And actually, she had much more fun with us, the kids, sure, than with the grown-ups. And she was there for three more days with her daughter, Tatiana. And we saw each other every day after that and spent all that time having a great time. To which, at the end, she said, give me your telephone number. There was no cell phones back then. Okay, I give the telephone number. And she called me the day after, as soon as I came back to Paris. And say, why don't you come and work with me? I say, this woman is completely cuckoo. 3 days of great time in Venice. I mean, you don't ask someone to go to work with you. But she has this very strong feminine instinct. She knew she wanted me.
Yeah.
And after the second or third time she comes, I say, yes, why not?
And so you moved to New York.
Well, I went to New York to see them. And I remember I arrived on a Friday.
It was your first time in New York?
No, I had been going for a few years already. I started going to New York since I was 15. And on a Friday, so well, the first thing, assignment, you have to do a knitwear line. It's about 20 pieces. And I say, okay, great. So that was Friday. And Monday morning, I arrived at the office with 50 drawings. So I think those are the 25 interesting, but the development on those 25. You know. And she said, when did you do that? So, over the weekend. Great, you have a job. I thought she was even more cuckoo than I thought, but actually she wasn't. And it was great for me to discover something that most male designers would never come close to. It's what it means to be a woman when you decide to maybe try on that dress and this thing. So, I mean, a woman's reaction to clothes. I mean, men don't have that. I mean, most of the men don't have that. Some do. And I'm very thankful to her because she got me onto a path that I would probably not have discovered for a long time.
And you worked with her for 6 years.
Actually, it's funny because years before, I had met at a party one of those crazy women that predict the future. And she told me I would meet that dark-haired woman in a city of water, and she would take me across the sea, no, the ocean, for 3 years, no, at least 7 years. And I thought this woman was crap. And then I met Diane in Venice. She took me to New York. I worked there for 3 years. Then I quit, and then I worked for 3 more years. So at the end, it's seven years.
I love it.
Things, it happened. I've never worked so much in my life, which I love, but I work endlessly and loving every moment of it because I didn't know. In France, we had 2 seasons. In America, there were 4 seasons.
Yeah.
Every season, we had to have 20 new prints for the wrap dress. And of course, we needed new wrap dresses too.
Yeah.
It was a roller coaster and it was amazing.
At that period, you met Umberto, I think.
Yes.
And quit fashion.
Yes,
for a moment.
I said, well, that's, I had been twice in love in my life when I was 25, and I thought it was already a lot. So I never thought I would fall in love a third time, which I did. And I thought it was really risky. But I said, why not? Let's go. And so for a year, we just traveled the world. Because he was a big traveler, and I had been only a working traveler. So we traveled for pleasure. When the year was over, I had told Diane that I was taking a year off, and I had to, how do you say, quit the job, to quit because I wanted to breathe and leave.
Yeah.
But no one was calling me somewhere else. So exactly a year after I quit, she called me, said, "Do you have a job?" I said, "No, actually, I'm starting next week to look for a job." "Don't look. I have a job for you." I said, "Oh, what is it?" Diane von Furstenberg Couture. I thought it was the strangest idea ever. But she was right. We had a wonderful time doing that. It's because our business was not doing well. And she knew that by having something as extravagant as the DVF Couture would put the limelight on her. And she did a fantastic job.
And your first four clients were?
That was it. The first two clients were obvious. They were Diane's friend. One's Bianca Jaeger. The other one was Marisa Berenson. Both divine and very easy to dress. And when I was called and said the third client was Cizzy Guest, and I remember exactly what she shows, I could not believe it. I said, wow. I mean, okay, Bianca and Marisa, kind of obvious.
Obvious, yeah.
But a woman like Cizzy Guest ordering a DVF couture dress, that's unheard of. The fourth client was Aretha Franklin. And I said, now, okay, that's the jackpot.
And so how long did you do that?
It went on for 2.5 years.
Okay.
And actually, what happened, we were on the first season, we made all the clothes on Fifth Avenue, 745 Fifth Avenue, which is across from Bird of Goodman. So every dress literally had a cost that, I mean, you couldn't make money on that because made on Fifth Avenue, it was really crazy. And as I lived in Italy, I proposed Diane and said, why don't we have the workrooms in Italy where the workmanship is of high quality and all that, and it's going to cost a quarter of what that, all that. So she opened a little company, she gave me shares of that company, and when she decided to end up the very costly couture business, said, well, actually the company has made money in Italy. That's my farewell present, so you can start your online. I said, I don't want to start my online. I said, but you have to. So she's the one who put in business.
That's amazing.
Actually.
And so you had your workroom already. That's incredible.
And also I had all this financial security because it was a very profitable company. But I had not intended. I like so much to be behind the screen. I don't really like to appear. That's why I love to talk on a microphone and not being filmed or photographed. But
did you know, when you started your own collection, did you know that you had a client in Italy?
No. Actually, I also knew that the influence Yves Saint Laurent had on me was way too strong.
Yeah.
So I had kind of to clean myself. So for 2 years, I did only made-to-measure special order things.
Okay.
Because I call it cleaning myself. I had to find my way. Luckily, Umberto, my partner, was born in Milan. He knew every single woman in Milan, and he did something wonderful. He just picked up the phone one day and said the same sentence to every woman. We were, of course, the next day they all knew he said the same sentence. He said, "Darling, I'm so happy to talk to you. I have such good news for you. Stefan is starting an atelier. You have to go there. Then the address is this," and put down. "Darling, I have such good news for you." And in a month's time, I had all the best clients in Milan.
Yeah.
What Deborah told you, it's also, for example, Wendy Goodman brought me my first account in America, which was Barney's, because she went to a party in Milan, and the three women she noticed were wearing my clothes.
Yeah.
And when they said, "Who does that?" and said, "Stefan Johnson," she pretends she heard of it. And the third one said, "Well, I have to get that clear." Then she went to another party, and the same thing happened. And said, "Where do I find it?" So here she comes. "I'm doing a story for New York Magazine. Can I photograph something?" "Sure." And I'm so excited. And plus, Wendy Goodman had been the first editor to photograph one of my couture things for Diane without knowing anything.
Huh.
So to me, she was very important. She photographed that. Then she called me and said, "Great, give me the credits for the shops in America." I said, "I have no shops in America." I said, "Oh, do you mind if I find a shop for you?" I said, "Please do." And then she called me the next day and said, "Okay, Barney's want the line. They accept the credit." And they became my first account. And again, it happened because, I mean, those women were noticed, especially in a world where everyone knows what you're wearing. All of a sudden, to have these things. and they look good. I mean, that's what I was telling your staff before. You know, I want my clients to be noticed for themselves, not for the dress.
Yeah.
Of course, the dress helps. It's an element of the seduction. But what I like is when they tell me, oh, I saw so-and-so yesterday. She looked stunning.
Yeah.
They don't tell me, oh, she had a great dress.
Yeah.
I don't want to know that, you know.
No, I agree with that. To listeners, so much of your life sounds like a fairy tale. But I know that you've had challenging times, too. Can you talk about the greatest challenge you had in your life?
Actually, when I was a kid and Saint Laurent, I saw him suffering so much on the eve of the collections. And I was wondering why, because I knew he would deliver something stunning and all that. Mm. But when it came my turn, when I was involved in the fashion shows and all that, the pain that comes with it is so... Because if you're an honest guy and you put... It's like revealing yourself every 6 months. And... if it's well received, of course, you're such a narcissist, you say, great, of course they understood it. If it's not well received, it's really painful. So it goes with that. I had experience like when I was asked to relaunch the Emilio Pucci label. For me, as I told you, my first memory of my mother in something fashionable was in the Pucci dress. So I knew exactly what it is to live in a Pucci way. And when Laudomia Pucci first met me, I was not at all on the list of her desired designers, but the person who was in charge of finding the designer when she met me, she said, you're the one. I mean, there is no doubt you're the one. And I was very happy because I knew I could do a great job. And I told Laudomia, I said, I would prefer not to appear. And she said, oh, that's nonsense. We have a market research. She said, it has to be a designer. To which I answered, yes. Okay, get Karl Lagerfeld to do Pucci. That's fashion news. You get Stefan Jansson, it's only quality news and no one cares about quality. Let's show them that it's alive and so on. And then if they ask who's doing it, we'll say, and Laudomia look at me and say, well, if you don't want the job, just tell me. I say, no, I want the job. When we had two seasons in Florence that were very quiet, but we were fantastic. The thing started growing very quickly. So we decided to have a show in Milan instead of Florence. And it was such a success that Laudomia suffered a lot because it was like she did not exist. It was all about me. And I hated it.
Yeah.
And I hated even more that she was suffering. That. And I said, Laudomia, I told you I didn't want to appear. But that's the way it is. I was the designer. But that, for example, killed my, in a way, my career because of the way fashion is. There was a stylist from Italian Vogue that was really... very ordinary to my taste. And when she arrived with the accessories that she had prepared without telling me anything beforehand, and first of all, the shoes were a knockoff of Prada, just that they were made in Pucci fabrics. And I told her, listen, I've never knocked off anything in my life. I'm certainly not going to stop under someone else's label. So the shoes are out. And then she wanted to put blue scotch tape on the head of the model. I say, oh, my ladies, that's the hot new thing. You know? So I had her fired, which made it that I was an enemy for the Italian Condé Nast, which back then was like kiss of death. I mean, you did not exist. So it's a miracle I'm still around because I really had everything against me. But
did you know at the time that it was a dangerous time?
Of course I knew.
Yeah.
But there was no way I was going to show fake Prada shoes on a runway, especially under a label that I had to honor.
Yeah.
And a label that never copied anything. I mean, Pucci has never copied anything. So the idea to have those really silly shoes just because they were printed, because she told me, but the print is different. I was about to kill this woman. And so I had her fired, so it was war, but I couldn't care less because I know what I'm about. And if I don't fit in the system, well, too bad for the system.
Yes. And lucky for us.
Thank you. That's very kind of you.
What do you think has been your biggest success?
I wish I knew. I never think in those terms.
For me, your biggest success is that you connect to each and every one of your clients. I mean, you really are, as you say, an accomplice.
I have to say, narcissically, I love the awareness I have that I'm part of my client's life.
Yes.
I mean, I have many women that seduce their husband with my dress, and that some of them save their marriage with my dress. And to be such an intimate part of a woman's, it's for a guy who's doing my job, I think it's wonderful. Of course, there are many designers who prefer to have yachts and residences in all the capitals of the world and all that. but I already have three houses to run, and that's already difficult enough. So, and I don't want a yacht, and I'm fine in business class. I don't need first class. And just because I have long legs, if not, I would travel economy. You know, my grandfather, who was a self-made man, his employees wanted to travel business. He always traveled economy, because when they insist, they say, what time does it arrive, the business class thing? At the same time, well, so it's fine. We're all in economy. Well, he had made this money, and he really worked every penny. And thanks to him and his legacy, I'm not, I don't need to show. Now I'm staying here in Charlotte in the most beautiful residence. And I'm like, wow. And I'm lucky enough to have stayed in other beautiful places like that. But I still take it as a present from life.
I think your life with Umberto, I think life got a lot more beautiful when you met him. Tell me about the adventures that you've had in your life with
him. Oh, God, no, we did an entire show for that.
Sure.
No, no, no.
That's a whole show.
But it's true that, I mean, falling in love with an extremely intelligent man is something that I wish to everyone, because you have ups and downs, but the ups are so up that you forget the downs. And also the vision. And of course, now it's been 38 years that we've lived together, and we're on the verge of incest, because, I mean, we know each other so much, and we don't even have to speak anymore, like in a crowd. We can look at each other, and it's like the phrase come out, and it's not just a signal. It's like a complete development of a conversation that goes, and we meet at the check, and, you know, and it's wonderful. And what he's doing now with the, I say he's doing because he pretends we are doing it together, but I'm just supporting. It's so wonderful because we are so privileged. And the idea that we can help an entire community just being the way we are, not pretending to be anything else. And to have, you know, in Europe, we have this big problem. You have it here too, of immigration. And of course, when those poor people come for a better life, usually they have a very, very bad life here too. But so now what we're trying to do is just to create jobs for these people in their land where they are. It's not easy, but you don't have to always to go for the easy choices. And it's wonderful to be part of this on top of our relationship, which is intellectually fantastic. But on this, it's being two men, we don't have kids, of course, but now we have like 400 kids in the village.
Exactly. I would love for you to talk a little bit about Rahuna, your garden in Morocco, where you and Umberto live part of the year.
So the listeners who don't know are about zillions of people, because we keep talking about Rahuna like it's a front page news, but it's actually a tiny little village in Morocco, northern Morocco, 60 kilometers south of Tangier, which is like the top city on the top of the African continent. And you're quite right to say, you know, for us, Rahuna is so important that it's the center of the world. But it's really like a village that till 10 years ago was completely isolated. All what we've built there was brought by hand, donkeys, mules, because there was literally no road. At one point, the equivalent of the National Trust in Italy, the FAI, came to visit the garden, and they are very wealthy people. And at the end of the garden, they said, what do you need for your garden? And they said, well, my garden doesn't need anything at this point, but the village needs an access. And if you could, you know, raise some money to make a little bridge, but very the cheapest bridge ever, just so we could pass the river and have a road, in 15 minutes, they pull out something like $50,000, which was exactly, no one made, because it was unexpected, no one made a price. Yeah. It's exactly what it costed to have all these things done. Huh. And so that's when Umberto said, well, you know, I never thought of it, but maybe we can really help these people. That's how it started.
Yeah. Most of the village works with you, or has at one point?
Well, when we built, yes, not only the village, but the next village and the next village. I called it the Cleopatra syndrome, because it was those endless lines, especially on the payday. And they were, Umberto was under a tree with a big bag full of money, and the guy and say, how many days, like much? So he gave the money. I should have filmed that, but I'm not very good with technology. And that endless line was like, you know, who are these people? And say, well, he's done the roof, he's done this, he's done this. And now, yes, we have six gardeners that are from the village, but mostly we got the little girls to make dolls in the Berber tradition. And now that's a big income revenue because we had shows in Milan, Madrid, London, Paris, Tangier, and going that. And then we have kids making furniture, we have kids making straw sculptures, and we try our best to have them something to stay there, substance, you know, to stay in there. Because the place where they live is so beautiful, but they had no idea because they didn't know anything else.
Right.
That's where they were born.
Yeah.
Now, because of all the people coming from all over the world to visit the garden, they realize that it's worth the trip.
And when you got there, it was just a bunch of rocks. I mean, it was not
rocks.
A garden.
Yeah. Thank God I took pictures back then of what, because now when you see it, it's so obvious that it's a divine garden and it's birds singing and animals going around. You know? But there were rocks. And actually, all the houses that, oh, it's three houses on the property, they are all made in stone. And so, where do you find those stones? Well, they were here, just made piles of them, and then we turned them into houses.
What do you love most about Rahuna?
The sense of space and the no limit. And you know, when I wake up very early in the morning and I look at the ocean, I always think, because New York is at the big part in my life, so I always think, well, my life, second act of my life start over there, and the last act of my life is on this side. I know it's a strange thing with the ocean.
But I think the most magical part of your life is with Umberto and Rahuna. It's just begun.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm glad you feel this way because that's reality. Sometimes when I'm alone in Milan, and I usually work like 12 hours a day, and by the end of the day, I walk back home and I go through the park of Milan, and my mind goes completely to Rahuna. It's so strange because I just like, it's kind of a meditation.
Yeah.
I walk in the park and I know at this hour what's happening on that, and I'm there and I feel wonderful.
I know you're going to say no, but on every podcast we ask
what
people wore to the prom. But I don't believe you had a prom in Paris. But I think your prom was that first couture show of Saint Laurent. What did you wear to that?
Oh, I know exactly what I wore to that.
I know what you wore too, and I think it is sort of prom-like. So tell
Oh, no, it's super prom. I had this double-breasted velvet blazer with a bow tie, a silk bow tie. I mean, all clad in Saint Laurent, from even the shoes that were one size smaller than my size, but I had to have them. You know? If I saw myself today, I would probably have such a look of tenderness on that little queenie thing going down.
Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thanks to you, Laura. It's a wonderful experience.
What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drozda. What We Wore is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network, powered by Ortho Carolina. Find out more at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.